It is almost 3 a.m., and you know what that means. Witches, goblins, and ghouls are about to be at their most powerful, and supernatural activity is about to reach its climax, if you will.
So pull out your harnesses and strap on your broomsticks, because it's time for
the Bitching Hour.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Hey everyone, I'm Maggie, and my dream role on Broadway would be the footrest turned dog in Beauty and the Beast.
And I'm Mia. I like shotgunning tall cans of Monster, listening to Seether, and scooping up your girl on my BMX handlebars.
Fuck off.
Stop. Seether. And here's the other thing. The way that I decided to write Seether as this intro.
Like the Veruca Salt song?
No, like Seether, like the band. They're a really bad band. But I thought about Seether because I looked up Papa Roach similar artists. To come up with that.
That is a choice.
As I sip my rosé.
That is a choice.
Okay, so today we are doing a segment called Bitchcraft. This is the first time we've done it on the show, so just a little description. Basically, Bitchcraft is a segment where we talk about things that we are loving right now, be that artists or musicians or comedians or movies, what have you. So Maggie and I today are going to just share some things that we don't know that everyone knows about, mm-hmm. share some things that are inspiring us or making us feel good or making us laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Maggie, you want to take it away and tell us what's in your brew?
What's in my brew? So the witches that I am totally feeling right now, I actually have been totally feeling these two for a very long time. So I have picked three different queer comedians on who I actually was introduced to on Twitter. So that's kind of how I first found out about them. So two of them, Rhea Butcher and Cameron Esposito, are actually married, and they are two comedians, and they have a podcast which is filmed live every week at the UCB Theater in Los Angeles, and it's called Put Your Hands Together. It's incredibly funny, and if you haven't seen Rhea and Cameron, I would highly recommend that you Google them immediately, mm-hmm. Google image search, because...
Yes,
they are both totally badass, and Cameron Esposito describes herself as kind of like a David Bowie-esque, like, mask femme situation, and Rhea Butcher is non-binary and says that they feel politically identified as a woman, which was so cool to hear someone else say that out loud. That's the first time I've ever heard some of those things that I really resonate with spoken out in the media. So Cameron has an additional podcast on her own that's called Query, Q-U-E-E-R-Y, where she interviews different queer luminaries, and it is fantastic. I highly recommend it. It's a little bit more serious. It's not the same as their stand-up, but I've heard some really cool conversations on there. And they also have a show together, which the second season recently just came to iTunes, and it's called Take My Wife. It is so sweet and so cute, and it is about the two of them being these married queer comedians and working together, and the fact that they constantly tour together, and so they're spending so much time together. And actually, someone who works on the show with them is my third witch for this Bitchcraft segment, and her name is Brittany Nichols. I actually admittedly found out about her through Autostraddle.
Honestly,
she's so cool, and she's very, very funny, and she does a lot of different writing for shows, and has actually worked on things like Transparent and, of course, Take My Wife, but she created this film called Suicide Kale, which is described as a mumblecore dark comedy, which I'm actually feeling kind of late to the game because I just heard about it and feel like I need to watch it immediately, so.
Amazing. Yeah, Maggie recently introduced me to, well, I haven't actually listened or... I haven't followed Brittany Nichols yet.
Oh, well, get the fuck on it.
But Maggie had been talking to me about Cameron Esposito and Rhea Butcher for a long time, and I finally looked at what they looked like. This is fucked up, but I looked at what they looked like and then was like, oh, shit, yeah. But I've been listening to them on Spotify a lot, during my commutes, which is really fun. So I want to share someone who does some comedy as well. So I want to talk about Aunt Freckle. I don't know if people know who Aunt Freckle is, and she's honestly amazing. So Aunt Freckle is a, I came to know who Freckle was because of Ed from Grizzly Bear. Mm-hmm. The singer of Grizzly Bear is best friends with Freckle. And she's a gender fluid, gender queer actress. I was trying to find this Instagram post she has where she like, she has this like promo photo where she's in an outfit similar to an outfit that Taylor Swift wore on like a magazine cover. And she posted a side by side and was like, you fucked with the wrong white passing Mexican gender fluid actress. Like I'm coming for, it was like honestly amazing. But she does this thing usually on Ed's Instagram where she slides down his staircase. It's like kind, it's like a curved staircase and she just slides down it like on her stomach. And it's unbelievable. Crucial Instagram is what I have written here in the Google Doc. That's just all like crucial. She's amazing. She's just so funny. She has a web series. I think it's called the Gay and Wondrous Life of Caleb Gallo. But yes, tune into Aunt Freckle on Instagram at Aunt Freckle. No spaces or anything. And then the other bitchcraft that's been just making my day. Mm-hmm. I recently read this article about this tattoo parlor in New York called Nice Tattoo Parlor. It's located at, no, it's in Brooklyn. And so their Instagram bio says, a tattoo parlor where everyone is nice to you. And it's two.
That is a real change of pace.
Right? It's two women tattoo artists, which is kind of cool too, that the people who own the parlor themselves are women. Mm-hmm. And I follow both of them on Instagram. I've been loving Hannah Kang is one of the artists, and I love her tattoo style and her art is just absolutely amazing. And it's just such a nice change of pace to have a tattoo parlor. Like they kind of, this article talked about how the decor of their parlor is like kind of femme and cutesy and mm-hmm. very clean. And it's, you know, there's not just flash sheets lining the walls like most tattoo parlors. And there's not just like men making you feel incompetent as soon as you walk in the room, no matter right. how many tattoos you have. Maggie and I were talking about this earlier. Like we both have several tattoos, but anytime I walk into a tattoo shop, I just feel like
yes,
stupid.
Yes, I do. I and feel like so a like a 17-year-old girl, and then as if you should be ashamed of being a 17-year-old girl.
Right.
It doesn't make any
it's
sense.
All bad. It's all bad. So yeah, so they have this, it's just a really refreshing take on how you should be made to feel when you're going to a tattoo parlor, going to do something permanent to your body that's for so many people self-expression and yeah. really meaningful, and for other people is like cathartic and just fun, and you know it's someone's art, and so it's nice that people are creating a space where first of all it's women centered, and also it's, you know, because also tattooing is so often mm-hmm. male dominated. But it's also a place where just people are fucking nice. People need to be fucking nicer. And I really like that.
We're recording again.
Here we are.
We're recording.
We're back.
This week's main brew is about gay movies.
Gay.
My favorite thing on the planet.
Yeah, so I came up with a list of possible movies and in true nerd fashion created a coding system for us to talk about whether we'd seen them, whether we liked them, whether we hated them.
What tropes they fit into.
Yeah.
So basically,
color-coded. I really went in on this.
As usual, we have a couple questions that we want to go through, and we definitely want to talk about just our personal opinions about what movies you like and don't like, because that's what you signed up for when you turned this podcast on. So I want to start actually with a Twitter poll that I did a couple months ago, actually like almost a year ago, but I put this poll on Twitter and Rochelle retweeted it, a friend of ours from Mount Holyoke, and she has a lot of friends on Twitter. And so
friends, people, not followers. They're her friends.
They know her personally.
Yeah.
And they all voted in it. So like 147 people voted. And the question was, aside from Bury Your Gaze, which is the the concept that gay people get killed off of shows. So, like, particularly queer women are murdered or otherwise written off of TV shows. So, aside from that, what is your least favorite queer women TV trope? And the four options were lesbian bed death, which got, like, a handful of votes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. A lesbian custody battle, a la Callie Torres and Arizona, whatever.
Robbins.
Arizona Robbins on Grey's Anatomy, which also got some votes. The winner, with hands down, was cis man breaks up an established couple. And a very, like, a relatively close second was a bi woman is just called slutty and her entire character has no development.
Yeah. I don't know that I voted in this poll because I don't think I used Twitter at this time. Also, still don't know how to tweet. Mm-hmm. But if I had voted, I think for me it's definitely cis man breaks up established couple. Mm-hmm. Because then you're just like, yes, we get to have this thing. And then you're like, oh.
We get nothing.
But my close second would not be bi woman called slutty. Mine would be lesbian custody battle.
Me too. Yeah. That's actually what prompted this tweet is that
That bothers me more than... I mean, it feels awful to say that bothers me more than bi women getting called slutty. But it does because, to me, it reinforces this stereotype or this idea that queer people are inherently bad parents or can't maintain... Like, I mean, I guess it's kind of... I come from a broken home. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. Okay. My parents are divorced and like not a big deal.
Right.
Not, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, I was born into it as that, but like, you know, I think divorce can be a really good thing for a lot of people, but I think that it reinforces this idea that either queer people should aspire to heteronormativity or should aspire to a nuclear family.
Right. Like all, and particularly that all women are going to have children.
Want to have families.
Right.
Right. Or, and then also it is like, oh, but they'll fail.
Right. Exactly.
That the queer family is going to fail.
I also see it very much as a vehicle to show everybody's worst stereotypes about women,
right,
particularly lesbians. Mm-hmm. So like, it's every way to paint the, like, the woman who didn't really want kids, a la Arizona Robbins, is terrible and all lesbians are too career-driven and drink too much and have too much fun and are too self-centered. Or, you know, a woman is too emotionally invested in everything she does because women are too emotional, period. And so, therefore, she is, like, actually smothering her child and not doing a good job. Like,
here's the thing.
Right off.
Actually, we're talking about Grey's Anatomy a lot. But I would venture to say that Grey's Anatomy hits every one of these tropes.
So that just, to get the heat going, to kind of start the fire, that's where we wanted to start off.
But I think that brings us, I don't know if you'd rather talk about specific movies first, but I think that maybe we should table this, come back to this poll when we answer the question, what bullshit are you willing to watch and put up with in order to experience representation? Because as much as I hate Callie and Arizona. I almost said Callie and Torres.
Callie and Torres.
All I care about is Callie. As much as I hate that it hits all those tropes, I'm also like, yeah, but...
I'll watch it.
I'll watch it. I want to see that.
I like, and not to sound dramatic, I need to see it.
Right.
I need to see that. I need to have this representation.
I need to see queer women who don't want to have kids.
Yes, I do. God, Arizona Robbins changed my life.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. Like,
so one of the other things that we... really, really wanted to talk about was the concept of punishment. Because I think, I mean, you see it in these...
Not in a hot way. Calm down.
But, so obviously you see it in these four tropes. But you see it in so many queer movies about really people across many different gender spectrums and in a lot of different situations that there is always this element of punishment. And some of it is a little bit more straightforward. You get things like... gay bashing and death and parents who disown their children and a lot of other terrible things. But you also see people who never get to experience love or are constantly struggling to maintain relationships with friends. And a lot of it's really tragic. So I think we wanted to talk a little bit about what kind of tragedy we see across different films and why we think that movies that are so tragic end up being the successful ones. Mm-hmm. Like, why are the ones that are so sad, like Brokeback Mountain, the ones that make it to the Oscars?
Call Me by Your Name.
Call Me by Your Name. Moonlight even, yep. which had a really sweet ending, but still was, you know, not mm-hmm. not like a super light movie.
Right.
Yeah.
Totally. And Carol.
Carol.
One movie that really just came up for me that I hadn't thought that I wanted to talk about, mm-hmm. because it's not explicitly a queer movie because it's from 1955, mm-hmm. is Rebel Without a Cause.
Okay.
James Dean. So, Rebel Without a Cause. So, I took a horror and melodrama film class my last semester at Mount Holyoke with Professor Elizabeth Young.
You're so fucking gay.
It was amazing. The last film we watched in the semester was The Babadook. So, you can see why I am this way. So, we watched this movie and we read some pieces about queerness in this film and how it's coded. But this mm-hmm. is the first time that I really was like, what the fuck is up with barrier gays?
Yeah.
So the movie's about Jim Stark, James Dean. Mm-hmm. He's like a rebel without a cause. But James Dean's character is kind of this nice representation of bisexuality. Mm-hmm. And of the way that presents for like men with like masculinity and femininity. And, you know, I think about sometimes the way that hypermasculinity to me is so gay. Mm-hmm. Like,
yes,
50 Cent naked on the cover of a magazine, or like shirtless on the cover of a magazine, is so homoerotic to me.
Right.
But it's this super manly, super masculine yes. image. I mean, yes. Black men are often hypersexualized anyway, which is its own.
Right. Yeah.
But I, you know, like fucking Channing Tatum, fucking Dwayne yes. The Rock Johnson, the yes. entire Fast and Furious cast.
Yes.
All no, of Step Up 2.
I know what you're saying, yeah.
Anyways, so there's a love interest that's a woman, Judy. I'm reading the IMDb. I don't remember this off the top of my head. Just so don't no one thinks I'm cool. And then there's a character, John Plato Crawford. Mm-hmm. And there's this kind of tension between the two of them. And Plato is coded as very gay. Even the way that he dresses, like... And he gets shot and killed.
Gay, you, as in feminine, or...?
Yes. Well, I mean... I'm trying to think about how he was coded as gay in the film and, like, what we talked about that has, like, some legitimacy besides me just thinking that. But he's kind of this, like, you know, he's kind of a misfit. He doesn't have a lot of friends. Mm-hmm. He's quiet. He is, like, you know, he dresses up. He wears, like, all the boys wear, like, those leather jackets and, like, you know, mm-hmm. crybaby uniform.
Yeah. Just to answer that little point about, is there some legitimate reason why I think he's gay? I also think that, like, as a queer person watching so much straight media, I think you have every right to... either call out or just find and celebrate the queer baiting and like putting queerness onto straight characters as much as you fucking want. Like yeah. you have every right to do
seriously.
That because it's not like they're giving you any others. So,
that's an interesting one for me that I think is a movie we don't explicitly think of as like, you know, because of the time that it came out mm-hmm. as being a gay movie. But
you think of that as a film where
explicitly The gayest character? They're all kind of gay.
Yeah.
Even Judy.
But, like, the most, particularly, like, the most gender-variant character.
Yes, the character that kind of challenges things. He's, like, always talking about philosophy and, like, the stars. And there's one point where a police chief, like, asks him, like, oh, have you gone to a psychiatrist? And the guy's, and so they, like, pathologize his behavior as well. And he says, like, oh, a head shrink? Like, no, I don't think so. And, you know, mm-hmm. like, he's punished throughout the movie as well. And James Dean has this kind of tension where he, like, wants to be around Plato, but he's, like, called into this other, you know, he's got this weird macho relationship with the other guy and blah, blah, blah.
I think that's so interesting that the one who gets punished the most in so many of these, not everyone, but in so many of these, is the most gender variant or the most mm-hmm. kind of, like, it's not even the most aggressive because it very, very often it's the least aggressive person, but right. it's the person who's the most aggressively breaking norms is right. the one who's punished right. the most.
Often the most vulnerable.
Or punished in the sense that they are the butt of the joke every single time.
Yeah.
So, but you talking about Rebel Without a Cause and saying that's not explicitly a queer film, it's like to you, it is very much a queer film. That kind of leads me to the question of when you were a kid and even now, what movies did you watch which are not, maybe they are and maybe they aren't queer specifically, but what kind of shaped your queerness mm-hmm. as you saw it through the media, and how did you find a spot for yourself?
So one movie that definitely, to me, shaped my queerness is Bend It Like Beckham.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Every character made me feel gay.
I think I've heard, and I heard this from another bitter queer woman, but I feel like I heard that that movie was supposed to actually have a queer ending where they end up together, but didn't.
Let's be real. Keira Knightley has Leonardo DiCaprio 1992 hair.
A huge part of the plot is that their families think that they're gay or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, like...
they are. Yes, hot babes playing soccer made me gay. I talked about another movie with you in the kitchen, though. Must have been Moana.
Moana definitely made me a little gay.
Well, what about you, Maggie?
Okay, there's one film in particular that stands out very much, and... This is a movie where the actual person that this nonfiction or like a historical fiction plot is based off of actually is queer. But the movie Capote really got me as a little kid. I mean, also very scary, mm-hmm. very much one of the spookiest movies ever. But this is the one with Philip Seymour Hoffman. And there was something about it that was so... There's something about seeing people who went... There's like when I was a kid and I was seeing these movies that weren't gay, you know, I watched The Birdcage as a little kid mm-hmm. and I watched other movies that are like very campy or like very much gay. Mm-hmm. And those had their own really special place for me. But there was something about seeing movies in which it was meant for a straight audience. It was in this world, which I couldn't have identified at the time, but it was in the world in which I was living. Like, my parents took me to see Capote. They loved Capote. They, you know, everybody talked about it around the Oscars. It was this big thing. And to me, there was queerness in it. Like, he is such a queer person and such a queer character. And they don't hide it in the film that he's queer. But, like, seeing a queer person, like, among us mm-hmm. kind of thing was so important to me when I was little. Like, mm-hmm. But
something I was going to say, too, is that oftentimes in, we were joking about Moana, and talking about just how, like, cartoon villains are always coded as gay.
Yes. Name me a Disney villain that is not gay.
Yeah.
Ursula, divine.
Jafar from Aladdin.
Gay.
The creepy salamander from Monsters, Inc.
Scar. Oh.
Scar is honey. Hot. Like,
oh, God. The crab from Moana, mm-hmm. Tamatoa.
We love him.
We love Tamatoa.
But... Also, but I'm thinking about the ways that queer people are kind of coded as evil in a way that just kind of drew me in more.
But, you know, that's so interesting, too. Like, I'm thinking about this, and it's making me so happy. Like, I love these queer villains like they're my family. Yes. I love them so much.
Yes.
But, and the reason why, I think it also ties back to the idea of punishment, too, is that, like, if we were seeing movies where queer people were never being, not being punished, because there's a really distinction to punishment, mm-hmm. but if we were seeing movies where there was never any of the reality depicted of what queer people have to live every day, I would be pissed about that too. Right. I'd be like, oh, is this all just sunshine and butterflies all the time? Because it's not like that.
Which is part of the reason that Ellen bothers me.
You're like, oh, you just like these cats?
Oh, you just like drink a fresh pressed juice and wear linen pants every day? Like she's a golden retriever puppy.
Okay, but you've got to listen to the Making Gay History podcast. It is so good.
Shouting out a podcast in the podcast.
So good. There's an interview with Ellen. It's the first interview that she did with this gay historian. I don't know. It's the person who runs the podcast. I don't remember his name. But it's like one of her first interviews after she did the coming out episode. And anyways, so
part of it
to that,
too, but. Is like, are we going to fault people for wanting, like, there's nothing wrong with wanting to just like be happy.
And just like is what you were saying earlier. You were like, gay people deserve rom-coms.
Yes.
Like, why don't we get stupid
Jenny's
Catherine
Wedding.
Heigl style?
Yes.
Who isn't Catherine Heigl literally in that movie?
She's in that movie. Jenny's Wedding is Catherine Heigl and Alexis Bledel.
It's on Netflix, so you can watch it.
Yes. And the thing is, Jenny's Wedding is not a great movie. It's kind of a bad movie.
Oh, it's a terrible movie.
Here's the thing, though. It's a shitty, corny rom-com. Mm-hmm. And the thing, though, that's interesting about that movie, first of all, who put those two actresses together?
That is the most...
boring...
Is that boring, any boring. Fun? Is your relationship any fun.
But that, and it's interesting because when you and I talked about that movie, because I was like doing research for this podcast and watched as many bad game Netflix movies as possible, you were like, I was like, oh yeah, I love that it was like just like a corny, shitty movie. And you were like, it felt so unrealistic.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about that movie is that the huge plot line of the movie is that Katherine Heigl's family doesn't want her to get married to a woman, is, you know, in that homophobic way that's really three-dimensional and relatable, that it's not explicitly, it's so waspy.
Yes.
It's very so implicit, like, very... well, that's fine, but like, what are people going to say?
No, it's like, we don't care.
So like a huge plot line is that her family, like, she's been closeted, like she's a grown-ass woman who's been in a relationship with a woman for like 4 or 5 years in the movie, and like finally is like, oh, I'm going to tell my family because I want to get married. And they don't accept her, and it's hard, and then like that's the whole fucking plot of the movie, but it still feels really unrealistic.
Yes. And so I like that, but the other thing is that I personally think that you can tell when I don't know all of the cast and crew of that entire film, but like when almost everybody's straight, you can tell that it's made by straight people.
Right.
Because it's not, it doesn't feel right. And that's why I feel like there are some films where I don't know who they were made by, but they feel a little, you know, they kind of get a good feeling to them in a different way. Mm-hmm. Like,
it's authenticity.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Totally. So one movie that I loved. I haven't watched it in a long time.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it has that feeling of authenticity for me or if it was just like, oh, sick, like these are hot babes and they get to be gay.
What is it? I'm sorry.
Imagine Me and You.
I never saw it.
I love that movie, and also it's the inverse of the trope of the cis man breaks up a couple.
Yes.
Hot Butch breaks up a couple.
Yes.
But she also is Tude Butch, not...
Tude Butch?
Yeah.
Attitude. Oh, like her attitude is Butch, appearance is not Butch. Got it.
Right. I think. Let me look up...
Tude Butch is a good shorthand.
You like that?
I want to start using that.
Tude Butch. I was trying to explain to a straight person the other day that I was explaining that Butch is not a short haircut.
Yeah.
And not that Butch inherently has to be outgoing or has to be aggressive or has to be, you know, like, get things done. But it's a tude.
So, yeah, just as a note, when we say butch and femme, we're not sticking to butch and femme as very serious identifiers. We are kind of using it colloquially. We'll talk about butch and femme in later episodes. So, take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah. We don't believe in anything.
I believe in nothing.
All I believe in about gender, sexuality, presentation...
is the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ.
Is the transubstantiation I'm getting from this rosé right now. Okay, so Imagine Me and You is like this fucking movie. A newlywed bride becomes infatuated with another woman who questions her sexual orientation, promoting a stir among the bride's family and friends.
Mm.
But she's married to some dude, and then fucking the other lady comes in and is like, nah, you like me. And she's like a florist. But they end up together. And that was like important for me to see too as a youngster.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't watched it in a long time, so I might hate it and think it's super problematic and awful now. But maybe I won't watch it because I'll maintain that nice memory.
You know what actually that reminds me of, too, is another Netflix movie, Below Her Mouth, which is, I mean, Erica Linder. Okay.
What's up?
Okay. But it's another one where it's a terrible film. Honestly, it's like not great. The acting is dreadful.
It's dreadful. Dreadful is the best word.
So bad. And it's not like it didn't do well. I probably was straight to Netflix or straight to TV somewhere. But they end up together, which to bring us back, to circle us all the way back to what we were talking about with punishment is...
the ultimate.
The ultimate is that like all of these movies that are totally tank... are the ones where the women end up together. You see it too. Right. There's this movie called Stud Life, which used to be on Netflix and was so, so, so good. And it was set in the UK. And it was, so that was interesting too. I think a lot of the kind of the onslaught of shitty gay Netflix movies are very much American. And so I thought that was really interesting. But it also is not like the most tragic movie on the planet. And it was incredibly low budget, and I learned about it through Auto Straddle, and that was it. Like, yes.
I just looked up Below Her Mouth's director on IMDb. They had an all-female crew.
That is so good. Here's another the thing.
Quick
plug.
Question. Could it have been a better written... Like, could the dialogue have been better? Like, great. Like, you had a great crew. But, like, what about the movie being whack?
So, Below Her Mouth. Check it out. All-female crew.
All-female crew. Like, yeah.
But, but looking at movies like... Below Her Mouth and looking at Stud Life, I think it's really interesting kind of what we've set up for ourselves around rom-coms. And particularly, we're talking about lesbian films or queer women films. Right. We're not talking about gay films, which actually brings me to another question that I wanted to talk about, which was camp. Because so much of the queer, which really we're translating to gay men, queer canon around films has been campy movies, and I love them. Like, it was so important for me to see The Birdcage and see these kind of films when I was growing up, and now I just watched Tu Wong Fu like a couple weeks ago, and it's lovely. But it's, how is it that gay male films get this whole segment which is camp, and for us it's just bad rom-com? It's like 27 Dresses but worse. That's not fair. Like,
right. And like, also in Jenny's Wedding, I think they kiss twice.
No.
And then in fucking Below Her Mouth, in Blue is the Warmest Color, it's just Crash Pad.
It's so exploitative. You wish it were Crash Pad. Crash Pad is actually like sensitive, cool and ethical. And, yeah. Like,
right. It's like, right. It's either like straight actresses playing truth or dare and kissing each other, playing chicken.
Yes.
And kissing each other for one
playing
scene.
Chicken.
Or it's just literally like, I was rearranging my room when I watched something Elena. It's on Netflix. Mm-hmm. But it was just bad. I don't even want to mention it was so bad. The title is regardless. It's irrelevant. But I was rearranging my room and I forgot that I had the movie on. And I had put my computer up on my, like, on my a chair because I was moving some stuff around, and I was like, moving furniture was kind of loud and whatever, and all of a sudden I hear like this weird noise, and I was like, oh my god, is the cat like trapped under my bed and it's like panting or something? And then I realized it's just like another sex scene of like 25 in this movie, and they're just like panting, and it's like the depictions of lesbian sex in these movies is just like it's just dry humping with a lot of moaning.
And they never finish.
Right. It just like, pans away to like something else in the room or like out the window.
Do you really think we would bother to have sex? I'm not trying to say that like all sex is substantiated on orgasms. For sure it's not. But like, do you think that, like, why is it that there are no orgasms? Why?
Because male directors have never made a woman come.
Oh no.
I'm just kidding. But yeah, it's like this represent... I mean, it's also like building the mystique of the feminine orgasm.
The feminine what a crock of shit, too. The entire concept of the feminine orgasm is the most transphobic orgasm. Bullshit.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
But anyways, so, but yes, I think it's really interesting that you have all of these movies, like the one that you can't even remember the title of, that are just such garbage, but then we still, there's kind of this whole... There's this whole cult following of people like John Waters, who I love. Right. I love John Waters. I think I think so much of his work is fascinating, but the entire canon of camp, like all of the things we talked about in our gender studies classes.
First of all, it's just the John Waters genre.
It is. It's just John Waters. Like, but then the lesbian films that are taken really, really seriously, like Pariah, for example, on Netflix, which I loved. I think, if you haven't seen it, I highly, highly recommend it. But it is really intense and very sad and really tragic. And it is
like hard to watch.
Very, very hard to watch.
I had to like go back to it like 3 times.
Absolutely. And so I don't know. I don't know kind of what I don't know what the goal is, Like,
it appealing to this, like, sense of emotional, like, the stereotype of emotionality in women? I don't want that.
Right.
I want campy butches. And not just camping butches. Because that's all I'm getting.
I want both.
I want camping.
I want a world where we can have both. And that's why I think people like Lena Waithe are so cool, because she is out here in podcasts and making TV where she's saying, no, I identify as masculine, but I feel more like a gay man than I do like, you know, this kind of traditional, super tough masculine guy. And that's so cool. Mm-hmm. We need more.
Like, right. Totally.
Okay. So I do think we should circle back, though, to the question of what kind of bullshit are you willing to put up with to see films? Because this is exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about all these terrible lesbian rom-coms that we've watched, and clearly we're willing to put up with some serious bullshit to see it. So, like, what are your limits?
Here's where I'm at. When I was a kid, I would, like, we're talking middle school.
Okay.
I used to ask for books for Christmas. I'd get, like, 10 to 12 new books for Christmas.
Are you coming out as a nerd?
Coming out as a loser. And all of the books that I wanted to read were, like, Girl Likes Girl, or, like, Is He or Isn't He? Do you remember all those books that were, like, all about sexuality?
Yes.
But often from the perspective of a straight person or what, or like.
Yeah, even like Flipped, those straight books, but that were those. Really, that gave you those like little tingly feelings in your heart.
And my parents, they would just buy me these shipments of books for Christmas that just were like, they were not great. They just contributed to stereotypes. They were all about like upper middle class or upper class white kids in the suburbs.
Yes.
But they gave me so much energy and life and like those tinglies.
Yeah.
So that's my background in consuming queer media.
And like being willing to put up with a lot.
Exactly. Yes. I was really willing to like read 300 pages of absolute bullshit written by a straight person in order to feel butterflies for a second when a girl holds hands with another girl in a book.
Ow.
Honestly.
It's too real.
I'm still feeling it.
I mean, I still feel that way. So I don't know. I think I'll put up with a lot. Like, Black Swan was one of my formative queer movies, if that says anything about what kind of bullshit I'll put up with.
Yes, absolutely. Black Swan, formative queer movie for sure.
So good.
Yes. The other thing is that so Maggie and I both studied gender studies at Mount Holyoke, and the chair of the gender studies department was a big film buff. By that I mean I think he has a PhD in film.
Yeah.
So film buff is a funny way to say that, but I'm honestly going to stick with it because if there's anyone in the world who would love me minimizing their PhD by referring to it as someone who like likes movies, it's him.
It would be him. Yes. 100%.
So I think that like I had never seen a Pedro Almodovar film until his classes.
Mm-hmm.
So like experiencing queer movies that didn't make me feel totally, totally awful. And those Pedro Almodovar films often challenge, like, make you uncomfortable or, like the kind of coming to queer movies in a way that's, like, Bell Hooks talks about, like, the oppositional gaze.
Yes.
And so, like, coming to movies in a way that's, like, I can enjoy this for its cheap thrills.
Yes.
Of representation, of just seeing that, of seeing two women kiss on screen.
Yes.
Of going on a date with a girl to a gay movie and being like, oh my God, like.
You know, I think about that too with, so my girlfriend is, has been out since she was really, really young. And the two of us will see something gay. Like that was what was so special about Rhea and Cameron, is that we listened to Rhea Butcher's comedy and Nancy looked at me and was like, oh my God, like, is there more? Finally, someone is speaking to me.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think I'm willing to put up with a lot of bad shit.
Yes.
For representation.
I'm willing to put up with a lot of bad shit for representation, and I'm willing to sort through a lot of bad shit to get the good nuggets.
And,
I'm willing to search through just, like, endless YouTube star after YouTube star before getting to comedians that I really like. Mm-hmm. And I'm willing to take class after class and watch weird movies to get to XXY, which our professor that Mia was speaking about earlier introduced us to. And it is such a good film. I mean, so unbelievable. And you get these moments where you're like, oh my God, I'm so gay. I'm the gayest. Yeah. Because, like, you finally saw, like, went through all the shit to get to a good
movie. Yeah, and that movie really... Mm-hmm. And that movie really just changed a lot for me in the ways that I think about intersexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I just, like, had this kind of, like, light bulb moment where I was like, oh, there's an infinite possibility of people's bodily expressions of what we think of as biological sex. Mm-hmm. Like, in a way that I had been like, oh, yes, like, gender is this, you know, social construct, which doesn't mean that it doesn't exist, but means mm-hmm. that it's implicated in a contextual way, and you know, we assign these meanings to it and blah, 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 whatever. Even theory couldn't get me to think about.
Absolutely. That movie was the first time that I ever was able, that I really understood the idea of, you know, everybody says, okay, well, sex is biological and then gender is a construct. That was like, actually, that's garbage. Like, that was right. The first time that I ever really saw that and it ever resonated with me. And how important is it to, like, how important is it to continue to see films? Like, we see so many straight films where we have to, like, figure out a way to relate to it, even though we don't really relate to it. And how important is it to see queer films where we have to make ourselves relate to it too? Where yeah. it's not just like, everything is not going to be for you all the time.
I mean, that's kind of how I felt about Pariah.
Yes, absolutely.
It wasn't for me.
Absolutely.
You know, and I think that was why it was important for me to watch it.
Absolutely.
That's how I felt about Moonlight. Moonlight yeah. was not for me.
But amazing, you know, and there were, yeah. and how special is it to like, to recognize that at this exact same time that you're saying, like, this is hitting such a deep, deep part of me that is resonating, like, so profoundly, mm-hmm. while I'm still recognizing that this isn't, like, I am relating to this from an external position. Like, that's so important.
Yeah.
And that's why, I mean, that's why we sift through these movies. Like, that's why we deal with
right.
it. Like,
right.
That's why we sift through all the Jenny's weddings and the bullshit.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And I think that's what's really cool about internet TV and internet mm-hmm. films is that there is all this access to all these different movies. Because I think what's important about queer movies and what I hope for the future of queer movies is just dynamic mm-hmm. representation. Mm-hmm. Because I will sift through the bullshit. I will watch bad movies that I can't relate to, not in the way that we're talking about Moonlight, but in the way that's like Jenny's Wedding. I'm never going to be just like...
You're never going to be a straight woman acting as a gay woman?
Yes. Yes. Well, I'm never going to be like a thin, rich woman who
right.
like is like, oh, like my architecture job makes it so, you know, like it's just, I'm just not going to live that life. But, you know, like, I will sit through those movies and I will because, like, I need that.
Right.
But also, like, the fact that there are so many different kinds of movies in this list, like, is pretty hopeful.
It really is. And I think
and also... I love bad movies.
Let's
watch South of Nowhere. Let's do it.
Oh, okay. South of Nowhere is not a bad TV show. It's a beautiful TV show.
I mean, Spencer's acting. The brother says, like, chick, like, 42 times in the first episode.
I used to say chick.
I've broken up with people for less.
And as a queer person, I reserve the right to say that Mamma Mia with Meryl Streep is a canon gay film. So fight me, at me, fuck off.
Done.
Done. So, this next segment is called If I Was Your Boyfriend.
Never let you go.
So, in honor of, you know, the lesbian icon, Justin Bieber, mm-hmm. we're going to be the lesbian shit show, Justin Bieber. We're going to be doing a little segment where we pick celebrities and we talk about what we would do if we were their boyfriend. Simple as that.
This game originated from me trying to think of ways that I could convince Hayley Kiyoko to be with me. So,
in honor of that, we're going to start with her.
Yes. Yeah. So, Hayley Kiyoko, if I was your boyfriend, I would never show up to your house party with some guy while you do a choreographed dance and try to make out with you in the bathroom.
Isn't that from one of her music
That's
videos?
The exact plot of the Curious music video.
Ooh. Okay. I'm going to keep it simple. Hayley Kiyoko, if I was your boyfriend, I would just sit on the floor with your iPhone and videotape you hip hop dancing for you.
Ooh.
And then I would let you edit them all and upload them to your Instagram.
Wow.
Because you're so cute.
Hayley Kiyoko, if I was your boyfriend, I would never bring up Lemonade Mouth.
Hayley Kiyoko, if I was your boyfriend, I would bring up Lemonade Mouth and say, I love you just the way you are.
All right. Next.
Okay. Next one is Katy Perry.
Katy Perry. If I was your boyfriend, I would run.
Katy Perry, if I was your boyfriend, I would once or twice try to give you a little bit of guidance as to my best suggestion as to not how to be a fucking asshole.
Yeah.
But other than that, I would probably give up.
Katy Perry, if I was your boyfriend, I would be a piece of shit dude because that's who you date. John Mayer, Travis McCoy.
Oh, no. Katy Perry, if I was your boyfriend, I would probably ask you about that I Kissed a Girl song and the You're So Gay song. Because wig? Honey, no.
Honey, no.
No, no, no. All right, speaking of honey, no, Trixie Mattel.
Trixie Mattel, if it was your boyfriend, I would forgive the fact that you're friends with Thorgy Thor and Milk.
Ugh, I don't know if I could. Okay, Trixie Mattel, if I was your boyfriend, I'd be a little asshole and make you sing to me all the time.
Trixie Mattel, if I was your boyfriend, I would convince you that you really did deserve to win and you totally beat Shangela.
I wouldn't.
Is that too hot of a take?
It's too hot of a take. Okay, Tatra Call?
Tatra Call, if I was your boyfriend, I would forget about the fact that you were in that Taylor Swift music video that was a shot-for-shot copy of Lemonade, only awful. Tatra Call, if I was your boyfriend, I'm overwhelmed by the thought of that.
Me too. Okay, Tatra Call, if I was your boyfriend, I would playfully make fun of you for those fucking videos where you overlay yourself with your harmonies over and over again, and then you film yourself singing.
Is it Musical.ly?
Oh, it's, do you remember the, like, this is 90s Disney? And it was, like, it was Tatra Call just, like, all next to himself in different Disney shirts, like, singing the same medley of Disney songs.
Oh, no, Tatra. Okay, Janelle Monáe.
If I was your boyfriend, I'd just be really nice to you. That's it.
If I was your boyfriend, I would just probably leave you alone because you don't even need me. Janelle Monáe, if I was your boyfriend, I would have stuck by you from the show I saw in New Haven in 2007 when I was 13 years old.
No fucking way.
Where you opened for Of Montreal and you painted a giant canvas on stage and gave it to the fans.
Holy shit. Janelle Monáe, if I was your boyfriend, I would be like that photo of Will and Jada Pinkett Smith where he has his hands up like
just on gesturing.
Exactly. Just showing on the red carpet like, don't look at me. Look at my beautiful ass wife. That's what I would do if I was your boyfriend. Like, because you look good in anything you wear.
Yes.
Rachel Maddow, if I was your boyfriend.
Oh.
Rachel Maddow, if I was your boyfriend, I can't compare to the hard femme who's 10 years older than you that you're married to, so I would just quit while I was behind.
Rachel Maddow, if I was your boyfriend, I'd be one of those suckers who's riding the train with a limp bouquet of flowers every day coming home at Downtown Crossing in fucking the heat at 6 p.m.
Rachel Maddow, I know that you have a residence in Hampshire County, so I would go all the time and get you Atkins Farms apple butter, and I would deliver it to our home.
Yes.
With a kiss.
Rachel Maddow, if I was your boyfriend, I would take you to Harold's, not even on your birthday when the ice cream sundae is free. Shout out Northampton.
It's free on your birthday?
It's free on your birthday.
The fuck have I
And
been?
They make you a sundae that's so big that they put it in the lid of a sundae container because it's bigger.
That's so nice.
Yeah.
Wow. Well.
That's if I was your boyfriend.
That's if I was your boyfriend. Maybe we shouldn't date anyone.
Yeah. Maybe we should just, you know, I'm doing this podcast just to get a girlfriend, but maybe I should chill.
All right, so thank you for joining us for the Bitching Hour. Next week, we're going to be talking about the bundled mess, which is bisexuality, pansexuality, and queerness. We want to dive into the language that we use to discuss it, the perceptions, and the lived reality of dating people of multiple genders.
And we're going to welcome our first guest to the show. We're going to have Elise Gillen.
Yay!
She is my best friend of 20 years, my current roommate. She's an artist and illustrator in the Boston area. And she's going to be on the podcast talking about this topic with us.
So get excited.
Stay tuned and follow her on Instagram.
Yes.
@ Elise Gillen.
Perfect.
Guillen.
See you next week.